Every story told has a story of its own.
If I wasn't in this room, what could I say to people so they understand how it feels to be in this room?
She said the words, "I won't forget it. What more do you want from me?"
It was on the fly decision making. It was drinking water from a fire hose at that point.
Bringing you the story behind the story. This is Reporter's Notebook. Now here's your host, Adam Roberts.
Welcome to Reporter's Notebook, where we take a deeper exploration into the biggest news stories of the past week, while also examining stories that I believe deserve a little bit of a deeper dive. I'm Adam Roberts. Thanks so much, as always, for joining us this week. Plenty to cover once again, including the big decision from Governor Tony Evers not to run for a third term, what that means for the Democratic Party, plus Kohl's is a meme stock now, that according to Redditors and Wall Street bettors, plus an in-depth conversation with a Milwaukee photojournalist on what AI could mean for the future of the industry. All that coming up on this week's Reporter's Notebook. But I wanted to start this week with a story that got statewide attention, and it concerns a city I called home for nearly a decade before arriving in Milwaukee. In the early morning hours of July 20th, in the city of La Crosse, 22-year-old Elliot Hines, a grad student at Viterbo University, was walking home after a night at Broncos Bar downtown. It was around 3:20 that she was last seen on cameras walking south on Front Street near the Mississippi River. That was the last time Elliot Hines was seen alive. A search for Hines immediately began later that day, with her mother, Amber, issuing an urgent plea to the La Crosse community.
Thank you to everyone who has come out to help us search for her and hung up flyers, all the volunteers. Viterbo has been really great supporting us. We ask that if you have seen anything, even if it's small, anything at all, you please call the La Crosse Police Department. If you have Ring cameras and you think that you might have captured an image of Elliot, please call them, let them take a look at your footage. Even if you don't think it's a big deal, it might be something that's a really big deal for her. Thank you.
As the story gained statewide attention, friends of Hines from her hometown in Hortonville, Wisconsin, came out to La Crosse to aid in search efforts.
I work with my mom and she's like, Brielle, you gotta go. I can't imagine feeling how her parents are feeling, and I just hope Elliot's out there fighting her battle and making sure that she stays there and knows that there's people out there searching, so that's why I'm here.
Tragically, Elliot Hines' body was discovered days after the search began, 7 miles down the Mississippi River near Brownsville, Minnesota.
You could just see her, even from the marina, once the scene where she was at, you could see that something was there, not a log.
What remains unclear are the circumstances between when Hines was last seen on camera near the Courtyard Marriott south of downtown La Crosse and when her body was ultimately discovered near Brownsville. In an official update on Friday from the La Crosse Police Department, based on preliminary autopsy results, authorities do not believe any criminal conduct was related to Elliot's death. However, final autopsy results are not expected to be completed for several months on her body, and the case remains an open investigation. Regardless of the circumstances surrounding Hines's death, the instance of young college students falling into the Mississippi River in La Crosse is one that is sadly not new in the community. During a stretch between 1997 and 2006, at least 8 college-age people from the La Crosse area drowned in the river, which is known for having a very fast current and being very unforgiving for those who aren't prepared to try and swim in the treacherous waters. Over the years, authorities have attributed the students' deaths to excessive alcohol consumption. However, it still remains unclear if Elliot was even drinking at all during her night out. The cultural impact of the drownings in La Crosse has persisted across the state. In fact, when I decided in 2011 that I would attend UW-La Crosse the following fall for my first semester of college, the warnings were plentiful amongst family members and friends to steer clear of the river while out. Some have asked if the city will consider building some sort of protection or safeguard from people being able to fall into the water in and around downtown. No official proposals are on the table in the city, and the subject itself is a difficult one to tackle. La Crosse has always been very proud of its status as a riverfront city. If you drive on the Cass Street Bridge heading east from Minnesota, you'll be welcomed by a pair of water towers with an eagle raising its wings over the river and the bluffs surrounding the area, along with the words La Crosse on the Mississippi River, Wisconsin's west coast. Its identity with the river is inescapable. At the same time, the danger is real, and it remains to be seen if the city has any long-term plans to address the matter at hand. As for Hines, Viterbo University plans to hold a memorial in her honor this fall once students return to campus. In a written statement following news of her death on Wednesday, the family wrote in part, "Elliot's walk home is finished. Unfortunately, our family's walk down this new hard path is just beginning." It was first reported a week and a half ago by WTMJ's John Mercure that Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers did not plan to seek a third term in office in 2026. This past Thursday, the governor making official what John first reported.
Would I win if I ran a sixth time? Of course, no question about that. But whether I'd win or not has never been part of my calculus about running again. For five decades, my family has sacrificed to give me the gift of service. They're my world, and I owe to them to focus on doing all the things we enjoy and love doing together. It's why, Wisconsin, I'm announcing that I will not be running for a third term.
So after the announcement, the floodgates then open officially. Who will put their hat in the race on the Democratic side? We got one confirmed on Friday when Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez announced her campaign had begun.
I've been an ER nurse, public health expert, and a small business owner. I'm used to being on my feet and getting right to the point. So let's go. I'm running for governor.
Lieutenant Governor Rodriguez joining WTMJ's Point Taken hours after the announcement.
I'm excited and nervous, and it has been a very, very busy morning. People are exhausted with the partisanship. They are exhausted with the two-party system. All they want are real-world solutions to problems.
WTMJ's Kristen Bry holding that conversation with the Lieutenant Governor. She is with us now on Reporter's Notebook. Kristen, pretty crazy end to the week.
Yeah, I mean, it's exciting. I was saying, as media folks, it makes our jobs a lot more fun now, right?
Oh, yeah.
As far as having both potentially two very crowded primaries for both parties next year, and especially because we don't have a Senate race for next year. So we'll have plenty of candidates to talk to. But yeah, I think this is interesting. I think it's interesting as far as the, I don't want to say uphill battle, but you know, with Dems have a new chair. And mm-hmm. So the challenge this creates for a newly minted chair as far as how you wrangle the not super popular Democratic brand name right now, but also historically statewide races for Republicans these last handful of years have not gone super well. So it kind of feels like no incumbent, the race is wide open, and there's not anyone so far that has so much name recognition that it feels like a clear front runner for either party.
So let's talk about your conversation with the Lieutenant Governor this past week. When you spoke with her, did you get a sense that, all right, what is my campaign going to look like? What's it going to sound like? Were you kind of picking up already that she has that plan already laid out? And could it look similar to what we've seen from Governor Evers the past two times
around? I think a little bit of one of the things that she said I asked her what sets her apart, even just from what we assume is going to be a crowded Democratic primary. And one of the things she led with was the fact that she lives in Waukesha County, right? Certainly, historically, a very red county, maybe
turning purple more so in recent years.
Yeah, turning a little more purple. But as far as she had flipped a district when she first was elected in 2020. So the bipartisanship, the ability to reach across the aisle, the ability to potentially appeal to more moderate independent voters, I think that was certainly a twinge of it. I think she's going to be running as someone who's worked outside of politics, because she only won her first race for state assembly in 2020, ran for lieutenant governor in 2022, but has worked then as a nurse and then for a healthcare company. And so using and leveraging her work experience outside of politics as far as setting her apart. And I also think she'll probably focus a lot on healthcare.
WTMJ's Kristen Bry with us on Reporter's Note. But before I let you go, Kristen, on the flip side of things, the Republican Party has two still confirmed candidates, though that is expected to expand. What could we see on that side? Because the name recognition is clearly there for the Democrats, especially with a guy like Crowley, Sarah Rodriguez in her position, and then the will he, won't he with the mayor of Milwaukee. What could we see from Republicans?
I think there's certainly a chance that Congressman Tom Tiffany could run, as was not confirmed, but also suggested by Bill McCosian on Point Taken on Friday. I don't know if he has statewide name recognition, maybe some. He is certainly much more conservative and has a very conservative record that in a statewide election, I don't know if that helps or hurts him. Certainly in a primary, it could help him. Mary Felskowski.
Okay. I think that's a name I haven't heard
mentioned. I think that's one or the other, because she is like, if Tom Tiffany were to run, she may run for his seat in the 7th district, or vice versa. If he does not run, then maybe she would run. The big thing to point out there is the fact that she voted against the budget and kind of made a big deal about voting against the budget.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think there's people who are just, you don't expect.
WTMJ's Kristen Bry with us on Reporter's Notebook. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you're a resident of the city of Milwaukee, did you know that your local alderperson who represents your district has a placard on their vehicle that allows them to park in metered on-street spaces without paying? Well, you do now, thanks to an article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel published this past week titled "Milwaukee Alderman Obsessed with Getting Himself a Better Parking Spot." Deserves a bit of a deeper dive for sure. So we're joined now by the author of the piece. He is Dan Bice over at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel with us on Reporter's Notebook. Dan, thanks so much for taking some time.
Sure. Thanks for inviting me.
Let's first explore how this came to be. What first tipped you off that there was something amiss here?
I heard that there was an alderman, I wasn't sure which one it was, that was very upset about his parking spot and was reaching out all over the government to try to get something done. And when I started checking on it, I saw that a file had been introduced at the Common Council to to change the parking spaces, number 6, 7, and 8 under the Frank Seidler building where they all park. And there were 8 names on it. So I wasn't sure immediately which one it was, but it quickly became apparent who it was. And it was Lamont Westmoreland, a relatively new alderman.
So did it catch you by surprise to see how many fellow alders had co-sponsored this resolution, which will be brought up eventually by the Department of Public Works? It was not brought up at their Wednesday meeting this past week.
Right. Yeah. I was a little bit surprised. I mean, it's a pretty cohesive unit right now, but at the same time, it's also easy when you're in public service. And, you know, I've been a reporter 38 years and I've been at the Journal Sentinel 33 years. It's easy for people in politics to forget that they're serving the public and to forget the perks of getting. But to be an alderman in Milwaukee is a sweet deal. You get paid in the, you know, 70 some thousand dollars. If you're in leadership, up to $80,000, you get, free cell phone. Health insurance is great. And you get a free parking spot.
Yeah, that was the other note to point out in this piece that was so interesting. I did not realize that aldermen got a placard that allows them to park in metered spaces without paying.
Yeah, there are two things. One, they get a free parking spot at City Hall, means they could use it anytime they could. And then they have this placard that they can put on the front of their car that would allow that allows them to park at any metered place in the city that they want to for up to 2 hours. The only thing is the form that they have to fill out when they get it says this doesn't apply. You can't park in a handicap parking spot. You can't park in a tow-away zone and all of these other things that it specifies. And Lamont actually has done that twice now where he's gotten ticketed despite having this placard. And the first time he took it to DPW and told them that they needed to rescind it, and they did. And that was in April, and then he did it again this month. And he first called the cops and told them to expunge it and get rid of it, and that didn't happen. So he took it back to DPW, And I don't think he realized I knew about this. So when I brought it up, he said, well, I don't know the status. If they've forgiven it, I want them to unforgive it. And I promise I'll pay this second one. But yeah, it is. I mean, there are a lot of these little perks like this that you should be pretty appreciative that you get these things, because not everybody gets them. And, you know, I park downtown. It's not cheap for me. And there are lots of other people who park downtown who pay a monthly amount. And or if you park on the street, again, those things are not inexpensive. And so it's easy to forget that you're getting a lot of perks that other people don't.
You mentioned the follow-up from Alderman Westmoreland. Have any of the other alders in that legislation reached back out to you since this story came to light?
A couple have wondered why I didn't name every alderman who co-sponsored, which I probably in retrospect should have done. So I wouldn't be surprised if a couple of them dropped their names. I was going to check next week just to see if anybody removed their names from it, but those who didn't sign wanted me to list everybody who did co-sponsor the legislation.
Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Dan Bice with us on Reporter's Notebook. Before we let you go, Dan, obviously a very big week in the political world. And now as we look towards the week ahead, what are you keeping your eye on? What are you checking the pulse for? And what do you think could be the next big thing we hear this week?
Well, you know, on the Democratic side in the race for governor, there are two candidates who have better name ID than anybody else, and that's Josh Call and Mandela Barnes. And I would be surprised if they both get in the race. So I think the thing to watch is who gets in and who doesn't. On the Republican side, it's a pretty lackluster group so far. So I am interested in knowing and watching to see what they do to try to counter the momentum on the Democratic side.
He's Dan Bice. You read him and see him every day on Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thanks so much, Dan.
Sure. Thanks.
Back in the news this past week, and not for any business dealings or CEO shuffling. They're in the news this week for their status now among the illustrious greats like GameStop, to a lesser extent AMC, the meme stocks pushed by Wall Street Bets, among others online, inflating their stock value this past week to double its going price at the start of trading on Monday, which was around $10 a share, ballooning to over $20 a share. Now, things have flattened out since then, but it brought back to light this idea of a meme stock. How did this happen to Kohl's? Why? And what happens next? WTMJ's Sean Brenda off the MPS beat was on this one for us this week. Sean, welcome in.
Hey, Adam. How's it going?
Good. All right. So what the heck happened, and how did the Kohl's stock suddenly balloon to the point where it was around Wednesday when it was trading for about $20?
Yeah, well, on Wednesday, that Kohl's cash really looked to be gold for a lot of investors. Mm. But, you know, it was one of those instances in which Kohl's got memeified in Wall Street and on the Dow Jones because Redditors decided to bet against the stock and to surge the price upwards.
So are you familiar with the original meme stock, or maybe not the original one, but the one with the GameStop trading in 2021 that really brought it to light?
Yes. During the pandemic, I was well aware of GameStop's monumentous rise to claim.
GameStop. I like what you did there.
Yes. GameStop amongst the GameStops.
So this idea of Redditors and stock shorters, if you will, being able to just balloon these prices is something we've heard of, but we haven't seen it with a local company before now. How did Kohl's respond? What did we see from the executive level?
Well, obviously, those Kohl's stockholders are thrilled about this whole ordeal. On Wednesday, I talked with a couple of Marquette finance professors to really understand, you know, why is this happening now? And, you know, Kohl's has been going through a lot these past few months. Obviously, we're aware that they had to go through two new CEOs in the past year and a half or so. And, you know, the ongoing search for their new CEO after firing, you know, Ashley Buchanan earlier, that really sort of gained, you know, a lot of people within Reddit to say, hey, you know, Kohl's isn't doing too well right now because they're losing their CEO. This is the perfect opportunity to bet against them and to raise that stock price up.
It is interesting because we have seen, obviously, as you mentioned, a lot of the upper level turmoil with Kohl's. And at the same time, we're seeing them, whether it's here at the Third Street Market Hall, where they've put that Kohl's Annex store right on Valar Phillips in Wisconsin. You mentioned an interesting little nugget, though, at the very tippy top or close to it with Kohl's executives related to this story.
Yeah. So I was talking to one of the Marquette professors, and she said that she was talking with a couple of people, and she learned that one of the Kohl's executives on Wednesday, when the Kohl's stock was at its all-time high, she was able to sell some of her shares for close to $500,000. Now, Kohl's says this has nothing to do with the price of stock going up significantly, and they say it's just purely coincidental.
I see their point a little bit because, you know, with anyone, if you suddenly see a stock you bought on the cheap going suddenly up, I mean, you know, buy low, sell high. That's the common nomenclature for the stock market. At the same time, it is very intriguing timing for someone at the tippy top or close to it to make such a move.
Yeah, it's certainly interesting to see that. But in this day and age, you know, when you see an opportunity, why not make that opportunity as quickly as possible?
WTMJ's Sean Brenda. Following the meme stocks, Kohl's did become meme this past week.
Yes, Kohl's did become meme, like GameStop and Blockbuster and AMC.
Thanks, Sean. If you read any news story, be it television, print, or even here on WTMJ, typically an article online will begin with what we call the featured image. That image, whether it's a thumbnail on an article or the first thing you see when you click the link, something that visually captures your attention. Now, there's a human being naturally taking those photos every single day in the news. They call them photojournalists in the industry. But as artificial intelligence grows in scope and in abilities, how does that impact what photojournalists do every single day? It's a conversation we're having every day in news, and we'll touch on that and more here now with photojournalist from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Mike DeSisti. Mike, welcome in.
Thanks, Adam. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, glad to have you finally in. We've run into each other on several stories over the last few months. We'll touch on that and artificial intelligence in a moment. But first, I want to begin by, for those who aren't familiar with your work, how long have you been in the Milwaukee market doing what you do?
Well, I've been here in Milwaukee for almost 18 years. Mm. I came from a newspaper up in Appleton, Wisconsin, the Post Crescent.
Sure.
I was there for 10. And I grew up in the northwest suburbs of Chicago and started freelancing photojournalism after I graduated high school. Well, I went to college and then after college did freelance photojournalism and then eventually got an internship in Appleton and got a job there and then eventually came down here. So.
In your childhood, was photography part of your life growing up, or was there a moment that kind of sparked the interest?
Yeah, you know, I always, when I was a kid, I always carried around a little camera or, you know, had a little, I actually did some film, like an 8mm, did movies and stuff and had my kid, you know, my friends in the neighborhood, you know, always making little movies and just always was interested in photography. And then I went to high school and really, and then even after high school, I went to a community college and wasn't really sure what I wanted to do with my life. And then I eventually chose photography, just more fine art photography. And then I went to school for, you know, just fine art photography. But then I got a job at the school newspaper and one thing led to another and I ended up choosing photojournalism. So
let's talk about that split then between art photography and photojournalism, because there is a difference in both what you're capturing and then also in how you capture the subject, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, the thing that I, you know, I, I love art photography because it's just kind of, you know, it's more you're, it's a different side of your brain that you're using. You know, you're more just kind of capturing images for yourself. But one of the things I really loved when I discovered photojournalism, I just got a job in college at the school newspaper to see, you know, I grew up looking at newspapers and was always interested in, you know, photojournalism just from reading newspapers. And I wanted to just see if I could do that type of photography, you know, after doing art photography for all those years. And I could do it. And it was interesting and it was fun. And the thing I liked about it is, you know, there was deadlines and you had a job to do. You know, if the mayor was giving a press conference, you had to go out and you had to get a picture of the mayor. It had to be in focus. And you couldn't, you know, get a blurry, esoteric picture of the mayor and say, you know, that's how I was feeling that day. I was feeling artsy, you know, or you didn't, you know, you weren't doing your job. And I like the accountability of it versus, you know, in art photography classes, you know, we would critique pictures of blurry doorknobs for, you know, a half hour. And, you know, that people would talk their way around stuff. And I just like the accountability of photojournalism. That's what really drew me to it.
But I also noticed that once you get really good at photojournalism as a craft, there is some element of emotion that a good photojournalist can still capture. If it's the mayor holding their finger at a press conference when they were really upset about something, a great photojournalist can still capture that emotion even while staying objective to the source.
Right. And I think that's what really translated, you know, into my photojournalism is my art photography background. I was able to carry over a lot of the artistic aspects of my photography from my art background into my photojournalism. So, you know, I can go out and, you know, I can make an artistic photo, I mean, if it's possible, of maybe a press conference, you know, where, you know, or you know, when it's some type of a news event, I can get creative and make it artsy, yet still have it tell a story for a journalistic, you know, aspect.
We're talking with photojournalist from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Mike DeSisti. All right, Mike, so I alluded to it at the start of the conversation, this idea of artificial intelligence in media and journalism. We had AJ Biopour from CBS 58 on the show recently, and he made a comment to me about going old school. He does not use artificial intelligence on the job in any capacity at this point, but we did both acknowledge that AI is not going away. And it's something that media has to tackle with as we approach how we present our content in the 21st century. What impact does AI have on the work that you do?
Well, you know, I do not. I mean, I guess I'm in the same camp as AJ. You know, I don't use it for my job. I mean, for one, it's unethical to alter any photojournalistic,
right,
you know, any photojournalism images in any way other than the way that you saw the image that you took. I mean, we don't alter images. It's just not photojournalistically ethical. It doesn't enter, you know, artificial intelligence doesn't enter into my field at all. There's things that scare me about it and things that excite me about it. I mean, what scares me about it is when I'm looking at images from other outlets, you know, maybe not necessarily photo, you know, from journalism outlets, but I'm not sure if what I'm looking at is real or not.
Do you find yourself if it's on X or if it's on Facebook and you see something having to go through like a mental checklist of, okay, that looks a little off or that didn't quite look right to me?
For sure. You know, I mean, everything you look at now and unfortunately what that has done is it's lended to I don't know if discredibility is a good enough word for it for the public to not believe in what they're seeing from credible photojournalists like myself. You know, they'll see a photo, and I've noticed this now when I post things, you know, they're saying, you know, that's not real or that you know, you altered that, you know, just because they're so used to what AI can do. And, you know, I have to, you know, I mean, you can only try to reinforce the fact so much that you haven't altered something or that you don't alter something. You can, or if you do, you get fired, you know, and it's just not worth it.
You mentioned, though, that there are some elements of AI and media that do excite you.
Sure. I mean, I guess the exciting aspect of it is that, you know, there's powerful tools out there that allow you to do things, not just with images, but just with, you know, with text or with everything that is all encompassing with artificial intelligence as the whole field expands. I mean, it's not something that I want to shun and say I hate all of AI. I mean, that would be ridiculous. You know, just like when I started still photography, I was shooting with film, you know, and then digital came along. If I was to say, you know, digital's bad, then I would have sunk in my field. You know, right. I can't shy away from all new tools. And I think, you know, to a certain degree, that's what AI is. It's just another tool that's coming along that's going to hopefully help me in some aspect in my field. I'm not really sure what that is yet, but it's not going away, like you said. And I will find some way to utilize artificial intelligence with what I do in a ethical way.
Mike DeSisti, photojournalist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, with us on Reporter's Notebook. I want to kind of peel back to the first part of our conversation a little bit. When you go to work every single day and do what you do, what drives you to stay with this industry? Because it's a hard field to work in. Photojournalist, broadcast journalist, anchor, whatever. There's got to be something, though, that drives you every day to do what you do. What is it?
Yeah, you know, I feel like I'm super, super fortunate in the fact that I absolutely love doing what I'm doing. I mean, if I was not getting paid, I would still get up and probably go out and make photographs in the morning. it's one of those circumstances where I think, you know, if you can find something that you would do on your day off and, you know, you can make that into your job, I mean, that's truly what I have. I get out of my car and I have to go and take a headshot of somebody, and I have my cameras over my shoulders and I'm walking up to their door, and I'm like, I have to pinch myself sometimes. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I'm getting paid to do this. I mean, I'm still, 25 years later, and I'm still like, this is amazing. You know, I can't believe I'm getting paid to go take pictures. You know, it's a blast. And one of my colleagues, Mark Hoffman, says it's like a field trip every day because, you know, like you and I were on an assignment the other day. We were, you know, at the boat auction.
Oh,
you know,
yes.
We're out there. And, you know, I mean, it was just, I could be sitting in an office, you know, doing something totally different, but I'm out and I'm, you know, learning stuff about interesting things that I would never learn about and meeting people that I would never get to meet normally, you know, in a different type of setting or job. It's just, it's a riot, you know.
Last thing before I let you go, Mike, is there a photo over your career in photojournalism that you've taken that you've kept over the years, whether you have it at the office, on your desk, whether it's at home framed? Is there one? I know it seems silly, but is there a photo that you've taken and you thought immediately, I want to keep this one safe?
You know, no, there really isn't one single photo. And I think I get asked that a lot. You know, what one circumstance or one favorite photo or assignment. And it really is about just the different stories that I've covered and it's not really huge. Like I've been to China, you know, for an assignment. I went to Prague for the Harley, Harley Festival and, you know, went to the Super Bowl and, you know, but it's just simple everyday daily assignments that, you know, you go and take a picture of somebody and they send me an email and they're like, the photo of my kid is hanging on our refrigerator and it's hanging on our grandma's refrigerator. And it's just simple things like that, you know, that really, you know, hit home with me and make me feel good about what I'm doing.
I still remember when I was growing up in Fond du Lac, there was a impromptu ice rink that the city made at Lakeside Park. And I was out with my family one day, and a reporter from the Fond du Lac Reporter was out taking photos, and they caught a photo of me because I was that kid that would eat the snow and then spit it out. It's weird and whatever, but she captured it mid-spit as I'm spitting the snow out. Nice. And my mom immediately wanted to laminate it. And while it's an embarrassing shot, it still sticks to me as that one photo that I always remember from the paper that was captured of me.
Right. Yeah. I mean, stuff like that. Just, you know, it means a lot to people. It means a lot to the community. It means a lot to our readers. And, you know, it's history for people. So it feels good to be part of that.
Photojournalist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's Mike DeSisti and with us on Reporter's Notebook. Thanks so much, Mike.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.